Case number 20-1117, Transportation Division of the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers et al. Petitioners versus Federal Railroad Administration and United States Department of Transportation. Mr. McKinley for the petitioner, Ms. Mundell for the respondents.
Good morning, Mr. McKinley. You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Sean McKinley, I'm representing the petitioners in this case. International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, Transportation Workers, Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, and the Academy of Rail Labor Attorneys. This is a case where the petitioners are seeking a review of a federal agency rulemaking. In this case, this is the agency in question is the Federal Railroad Administration, and the rulemaking had to deal with so-called risk reduction programs, which are mandated by the Rail Safety Improvement Act of 2008. The FRA has broad authority granted to it by Congress to oversee safety concerns in the United States rail transportation system. That extends to rulemakings. The FRA is the body that's primarily responsible for rulemakings in the railroad industry in the United States. Now, this broad authority, though, is not limitless. The FRA is limited by, the mandates from Congress as expressed through various statutes. In this case, the limitations on the FRA's authority is limited by the Rail Safety Improvement Act, as mentioned, and also the Administrative Procedure Act, as this is a formal notice and comment rulemaking, as that is defined under the APA.
Mr. McKinley, let me start, if I may, with a couple of questions about your standing and maybe about remedies, and there may be some overlap. One of your arguments is that we should vacate the rule because it was tardy by about 11 years or 4 years. It was very late. And I would take it to be that your injury for Article 3 standing purposes is, well, there was this gap in time when the rule should have been in effect, when a rule should have been in effect, and it wasn't in effect for that gap of time. And we were injured because I guess a rule would have been better protecting you in terms of safety. But in terms of redressability, we can't go back in time. And so I'm not sure how vacating the rule, or even just remanding it without vacating it, with regard to the tardiness, would do anything to redress the injury you suffered of going those 11 years or 4 years without a rule in place. So can you help me with that? How is this, with regard to the timeliness claim, how is this a redressable injury?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. I guess to answer that, I would say that the Congress and the FRA's own regulations, as you kind of intimated, require that the FRA complete rulemakings within 12 months from the date that the NPRM is published in the Federal Register. And as far as just to get us directly to your question, the NPRM was issued in February of 2015, when the final rule was promulgated in February of 2020. So we're talking about a 5-year gap there.
It was supposed to be done in a year. So let's say that there was a 4-year gap where you were injured because a rule was not in place. How is that injury redressable by this court?
Well, I would define the injury a little bit differently, Your Honor. I would define it as the process for the rulemaking is 12 months, as we said. During that process, the FRA is required to solicit and receive public comments. It's an active process with the public and stakeholders in the industry. In this case, the FRA had accepted rule comments in April of 2015 through essentially October through a few different rounds of comments, and then did nothing for 4 years. And
I
think
you file an action seeking to compel the agency to complete what they're supposed to do. If we followed your approach, do you know how many things we'd vacate? Agencies are rarely on time. But to add to what my colleague is saying, it doesn't make sense intuitively. How is that giving relief? What do you want us to do? Just vacate and say, go away? You can't do anything now?
Why?
Do it promptly or what? What are you saying?
Well, I would say vacate, and if the FRA to the NPRM can be reissued and they can complete the rulemaking within a year.
It's still late.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
It's still late.
Well, this particular final rule is late, but if the FRA presumably restarted the process, they would have 12 months then to complete the rulemaking under 49 CFR 211.
You commented, right? During the notice and comment period, some of these petitioners did file comments. Is that right?
Yes.
And so is there something that happened as the result of the delay from a procedural perspective, from a, you know, not that due process applies, but from a procedural, is there something that happened procedurally that went wrong that you think would go right if we vacated and remanded this and did it all over again?
Well, I think as I was getting to before, I think the issue is that the FRA was acting on information that was 4 years after it was submitted. This is an industry that changes from year to year. Technology changes, safety concerns change year to year. The FRA's final rule here is based on stale information at this point, stale comments from 5 years ago. And
can
I think
can you be specific about that in a way that's specific enough to give me something to go on?
Well, certainly. I guess, for example, I would say part of the Rail Safety Improvement Act was the implementation of positive train control technology. It's essentially a technology that is an additional safeguard on trains that permits if a train misses a conductor engineer misses a signal, the train can enter into a stop, like an emergency stop or something like that. This technology.
There was information that was not available at the time that's available now. But if the rule had been promulgated earlier, you still wouldn't have known. You still would have been promulgated based on the new rule. I guess that's another way of saying it is, if the information between 2015 and 2016 is now stale, the rule, had it been promulgated in 2016, was still going to be promulgated based on that stale information, even if it had been promulgated on time. So I'm not sure I'm with you there. You can respond to that. And if you would also respond to this, you put a heavy emphasis on vacating as opposed to just remanding, not just for this claim, but for the fatigue management claim as well. Is your position that you want us to either vacate or do nothing? Is your position that a remand is not acceptable to you?
I wouldn't say not acceptable. I would say the law requires under the APA, Section 706 of the APA, just that requires that the agency action be set aside.
But this court has precedents about when to vacate and remand versus when to just remand without vacating. And we look at how disruptive would it be, and we look at how bad, how wrong, how easy to fix it would be, the original rule that has some problem in it. I mean, under that test, are you saying we should either vacate or just deny your petition?
Well, I believe that vacater is the remedy here, because nothing prevents the FRA from restarting the rulemaking process with information that is fresh and available. And I think based on the circumstances that exist, this is a rule that is.
I understand the argument, but I just want to know if you are also making an alternative argument, and then I'll get out of the way here. Assume that we conclude that vacating is not the appropriate remedy, and assume that we are inclined to sua sponte, even though you didn't ask for this, remand maybe on the fatigue management question without vacating. Is it your position that we should not sua sponte remand, that instead of that, we should just deny the petition?
Well, if that were the case, we would welcome the sua sponte action to remand for further rulemaking if that's what the court decides is appropriate.
And I didn't mean to monopolize the questions here, so I'll stop.
Mr. Tinley, do you read the statute? I mean, moving to the fatigue management plan, do you think it would be lawful for the FRA to accept a risk management program that did not include a fatigue management plan?
Well, I think that goes to kind of the heart of the issue of what we argue with the fatigue management plan, is that Congress mandated that fatigue management plans are required components of risk reduction plans. And I would argue, and I put to the court here, that a risk reduction plan that does not have a fatigue management plan doesn't comply with the mandate of Congress. Hopefully that answers your question.
Well, but what if that plan, I mean, is there anything in the statute that requires all of those components to be approved by the agency at the same time?
Right.
Well, I would say that there's not anything that requires it to explicitly to be all approved at the same time, but I would point to the subsection in the RSIA where the fatigue management plans are included. It's a required component. So then the question becomes, I believe, at what point then are fatigue management plans to be then included in risk reduction plans? How long are we to go with risk reduction plans that do not have fatigue?
So that claim though isn't yet ripe, is it? Right. So if, for instance, the agency begins accepting these plans, or say we call them partial risk management plans because they don't have the risk manage the fatigue management component, wouldn't your claim then only become ripe at the point at which the agency is, you know, regularly accepting these risk programs without a fatigue management plan?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that at this point, the development of risk reduction plans is now currently ongoing. This is the process there to be submitted by Class 1 carriers August 21st of this year. So that development is currently ongoing. If you're suggesting that we would have to wait until plans are submitted for review by the FRA and the FRA then approves of these plans in order for the action to be ripe, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, because I think that the final rule is clear. And the FRA has stated its intent clearly that they're moving forward with this without the fatigue management plan component at this time. And that is how the process is going to move forward. And the FRA has indicated that they're doing a separate rulemaking with fatigue management plans. They issued the NPRM for that, I believe, on December 9th of 2020. But based on the timeliness of how long it took the FRA to issue a final rule with the risk reduction plan, I think we could be looking at a period of years without fatigue management plans.
How much time between the end of the comment period and the final rule?
The end of the comment period, the FRA had reopened it twice. I believe the comment period ended, I hesitate to say a specific date, but it was mid-October of 2015. And then the final rule was issued on February 10th of 2020. So that's more than four years and 2 months or so.
Okay.
And I guess I'm into my rebuttal time, so I guess I'll reserve what's left.
Okay. Do my colleagues have any further questions?
Not me.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Mundell?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Amanda Mundell on behalf of the respondent agencies. This petition should be denied. And I'd like to start by responding to two of the points that petitioner has raised today. The first is with respect to the remedy that they've requested. As the court's questions suggest, vacatur here doesn't make sense as a practical matter. And it also is a remedy that no court has ever ordered with respect to delayed agency action, at least as far as when a statute doesn't have a penalty for noncompliance, which is exactly the case here. And I think as Judge Edward points out, you know, if it were really up to the courts to vacate a rule every time an agency misses a statutory deadline, there would be vacatur constantly, and it would stymie and bottleneck agency operations even further. And I think the point is underscored by the fact that, you know, petitioners have suggested an argument today that, you know, part of the reason why maybe vacatur makes sense is because the rule might have been relying on stale information. But the only example that they've now offered is a part of the rule that they haven't even challenged, which is about positive train control. So even that doesn't serve as a basis for vacatur here. I think at the end of the day, you know, this is a rule that unfortunately took several years, but it wasn't the result of the agency thumbing its nose at Congress or flouting the congressional, you know, requirements to attempt to make this rule in a timely fashion. This is a rule that is massive. It involves several components, meetings with stakeholders, and the agency wisely acknowledged that reopening the comment period would have been necessary, that several public hearings would have been required to push this rule out. And ultimately, we do have a rule that I think petitioners agree needs to exist in some form. So vacating it, bringing us back to the status quo where there weren't extensive regulations in this area.
Ms. Mandel, let me ask you about the performance-based standards, which your opposing counsel didn't have a chance to touch on. There's nothing wrong with performance-based standards, at least in terms of what the statute allows, what APA would allow. But I had a hard time finding out what the standard is in this performance-based standard. And so I have some concern that the standard is so non-specific here that it's a standardless standard. So can you help me with that a little bit? And maybe as you do so, I'd be curious to know what precedent you would recommend I read where a court finds not arbitrary and capricious a standard that is as non-specific as your standard here.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, we don't think there's a non-specific standard. I mean, Congress's mandate here is quite broad to reduce safety hazards and safety risks on train operations. And so to accomplish that objective, the performance-based aspect of this rule is first requiring railroads to identify those safety objectives on their systems. So perhaps some railroads have issues with derailment. That would be an objective that they would want to achieve under this rule would be reducing derailment. Other railroads might deal with more environmental-based hazards. Maybe other railroads deal with electronic or technological issues. So the rule puts it at first, at the first step in the railroad's corner to identify those objectives, and then requires them to identify a process or a system of steps that can address those objectives and mitigate those risks.
And in terms of those objectives, I mean, how would anyone ever know if those objectives are enough? So like, let's say that a train has 500 of a specific type of infraction per year on average over the past decade, and they set a goal of improving that so that they now only have 499 of those infractions per year going forward. I mean, would that satisfy the performance-based standard? And if it wouldn't, why wouldn't it?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and I think there's two responses to that. I think the first, we have to take a step back and realize that this is an iterative process that isn't just fixed in stone. So the railroads are not just setting objectives, attempting to meet those objectives, and then never addressing additional safety risks to begin with. It might well be that when there are 500 infractions, reducing that down by one is actually a significant improvement. But this rule wouldn't just require them to stop there. Railroads are constantly required to address additional risks on their system. And the second aspect of my response to your question, Your Honor, is that we know that this would be, a good step to take because this is a collaborative process. The rule envisions collaboration between FRA, railroads, and other interested stakeholders, including petitioners here, including labor unions. And labor unions have the opportunity to raise these additional concerns both to the railroads and to FRA, so that FRA is aware of, what risks exist on these systems and how best to address them. So I don't think that there's an oversight problem there.
What's the difference between non-binding guidance from the agency and your standard, which is reportedly a legally binding standard?
Well, Your Honor, this performance-based standard, this type of rule, requires these railroads to put together a plan that have objectives and certain processes in there that the agency is going to approve, and it requires periodic audits. So it's not as if the agency just sort of gives them a standardless guidance and railroads are off on their own to implement these programs as they see fit. Railroads have to do their own internal audits, and FRA has to conduct periodic audits under the rule. And if there is no compliance with the program, or if the railroad is consistently falling short of its deadlines or an implementation schedule, the statute itself authorizes the agency to seek civil penalties for that. So I think there's—
But I guess, when would they seek the civil penalties? Is it a bad faith standard? These railroads are supposed to do these internal audits and figure out what's not terrific, and then they make some reforms and they set some goals. And if they are doing that in good faith, then they don't get penalized by the agency. And if they're doing that in bad faith, they do get penalized. But is it a good faith standard?
Your Honor, I don't think the standard is a good faith standard, but, you know, candidly, I think this is a case by case determination when, you know, if a railroad consistently is falling short of their obligations under the plan. But what I can tell you is that, again, this is a collaborative process. The agency is consistently reviewing these plans. The railroads are consistently updating them and implementing additional measures to address new hazards or new risks. And the employees themselves have the opportunity to flag any areas of concern for the agency in the course of the review process.
Okay.
Ms. Mandel, if I can ask you, so if we were to accept that the agency can promulgate the fatigue management plan separate, right, from its risk reduction program more generally, can the agency accept the risk reduction programs without a fatigue management plan under the statute?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And this was the second point that I wanted to raise in response.
Even though they're required components of such a program?
Absolutely. And I think, Judge Rao, as your question to petitioners suggested earlier, there's nothing in the statute that prohibits the agency from, you know, implementing Congress's mandate in a series of steps to first require risk reduction programs that have certain components and then to require an additional component. And there's nothing in the statute that prohibits or requires even railroads to implement all of these various components at the exact same time. And here it's well within the agency's discretion to first promulgate a rule addressing components 1, 2, and 3, and to add an additional rule addressing that last component. And just for what it's worth, you know, these fatigue management plan requirements, once there is a final rule on fatigue management, will automatically get incorporated into a railroad's risk reduction program. So they're not, you know, it's not as if railroads are ignoring fatigue management issues altogether. It's just that this part will come later.
It's only a matter of time. So do you agree that if, say, in some number of years, the agency did not have a fatigue management plan and these programs were regularly getting approved without fatigue management plans, that would at some point be contrary to law or ultra vires or?
Well, I think petitioners might try to bring an action to compel agency action, which, you know, it unlawfully withheld or unreasonably delayed. But here, of course, we have a rule in the process. The comment period has closed as of about a week and a half ago. And there's really no reason to expect the agency not to work diligently to issue that rule. I think it's worth pointing out that fatigue management is a much more discrete area than risk reduction programs, which involved a number of different concerns and moving components. It's also an area where the agency has extensive experience. So, you know, I think it would be difficult to expect a rule to issue, you know, right away within the next few months, because of course, you know, review processes take time, but I would be surprised if a rule took an extensive amount of time in light of the fact that this is just the last piece of the puzzle here.
Okay, that's helpful.
Your Honors, if there are additional questions, I'd be welcome to answer them.
Do my colleagues have any further questions? No? Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors. We just ask that the petition be denied.
Thank you, Ms. Mundell. Mr. McKinley, we'll give you 2 minutes. You're muted.
I think you're on mute.
My apologies. just to address briefly a few things that were said, with regard to fatigue management plans, the respondents suggest that they're allowed to address this matter in a series of steps, partial compliance one step at a time, however it's been defined. And I would like to point out, though, that, you know, there is a requirement, though, that the FRA is required to explain why the problem should be treated this way. The FRA has not put forth any explanation for why there needs to be a separate rulemaking for fatigue management plans. And in fact, I think the record really cuts against their argument that the FRA submitted the fatigue management plan issue to the RSAC working group, it's called, in 2012, which then passed on its recommendations then. And then the FRA has not taken any action since until December 9th of 2020. And in the final rule, they simply state it should be addressed in a separate rulemaking. Well, why couldn't they be addressed at the same time? And these are just speculative questions because we don't know the answer because the FRA hasn't provided any sort of explanation for that. To my last point, I guess, with Judge Walker, you raised a good point. It's a nonspecific standard, and the FRA made it clear that it was particularly concerned with the financial burden on smaller railroads versus larger railroads when it comes to developing and implementing these plans. Now, but I think the final result, Judge Walker, as you said, is that This is a very nonspecific standard. The FRA indicates in the final rule that it has the ability to scale down the rule 60%. They don't explain how the rule can be scaled down. When you look at subpart B of the final rule, there is no explanation in any way of how the rule can be scaled down. So I think what we have is a kind of ill-defined minimum standard that applies across all railroads.
And don't the standards have to be approved by the FRA?
Well, yes, Judge, they do have to be approved by the FRA, but I would also point out that the final rule doesn't contain any sort of real process for how these plans are to be approved. The FRA is fairly silent on that. It seems to be, I think, as a respondent stated, a sort of case-by-case basis. And that's not really a useful rule here. This is, as I think Judge Walker said, it's more guidance than anything else. And I don't think, in this case, railroads necessarily know if they're going to comply, if they submit something to the FRA, if it'll be approved, and how exactly that process works. It's not defined in the final rule. And I'm into my time. If there's any other questions, I'd answer them. If not, I'll just ask that the rule be vacated.
Thank you, Mr. McKinley. This case is submitted.